Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. I hope that you're having a good week so far. It was lovely to hear your reaction to last week's episode with Bill Bailey. I'm really pleased that you enjoyed it. Bill and I talked a lot about the Bath area of England in Wiltshire, and he goes back there an awful lot. Coincidentally, then I spent the weekend there last weekend. Such a magical place in the build up to Christmas. If you're able to get there, they've got some fantastic Christmas lights and markets. And I think because the architecture is so consistently perfectly preserved in Bath, it feels like you're walking around a film set. So absolutely loved it. We stayed at Lucknam Park Hotel, which is a country house hotel just outside of Bath, about 20 minutes drive in. Lucknam Park might ring a bell, as Claire Balding picked it as her favourite dog-friendly place to stay on her episode of The Travel Diaries. So it seemed only fitting that we should bring our Cavapoo Indy with us. And she was in her element because the house is set on 500 acres of beautiful parkland. So she just ran wild for hours. And the house itself is just stunning. It's a Palladian mansion dating back to the 1720s. And you can stay in the house. We stayed in one of the cottages in the grounds, which is a great option for a family because it has its own stocked kitchen and a big living room with a wood-burning fire. Very, very cozy, very Christmassy. And totally set up for everything you need with a dog too. You know, beds, bowls are all there for you when you get there. So when we went out with Indy or exploring Bath, we had a really relaxing time in the spa there. The restaurant at Lucknam Park is Michelin starred. Restaurant Howell Jones. What an amazing place. Classic modern British cuisine in a timelessly elegant setting. What I imagine used to be the ballroom in the house. And it was amazing. If you're in the Wiltshire area and you fancy a special treat meal, you will not regret it. So on to today's guest. Speaking of delicious food, I am joined by a legend of the culinary world, the chef, restaurateur and broadcaster, Michelle Roux. The story goes that Michelle was practically born in a kitchen when his mother went into labour during service at his father's restaurant. He's the son of Albert Roux and the nephew of Michelle Roux, brothers who revolutionised the restaurant business in the UK when they opened Le Gavroche in 1967, famously becoming the first establishment in this country to gain one, two and then three Michelin stars. When his father retired in 1993, Michelle took over this world famous restaurant, quickly becoming a household name on TV shows like MasterChef The Professionals, Remarkable Places to Eat, and he now has another new TV show set in Provence, which he'll tell us all about. We recorded this on Zoom a little while ago, and the Zoom robot voice does pop up occasionally on this one. I'm sorry about that, but I hope that you really enjoy the episode, especially as chefs tend to be so well-travelled, and Michelle is no exception. His travel diaries take us on a delectable journey from Lyon to Hong Kong, the Seychelles to Las Vegas. So, let's get started. Michelle Roux, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. What an honour it is to be joined by you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be with you and to discuss and to have a bit of fun.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we're going to go on a journey through the seven chapters of your life's travel diaries, uncovering all kinds of amazing and wonderful places along the way. Let's start with chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
I remember traveling with Dad and Mum to Scotland and traveling in an old, I think they were called Morris Minors, the cars that had wooden paneling on the inside and outside. So you can imagine driving from Kent all the way up to the northern sort of Northern Isles, and in right up to Inverness and further, was quite a trek and quite an adventure. And I do remember that, and I remember the cold, sort of brisk air, even in the summer months of Scotland.
And where in Scotland was it that you were going, and like, what was the kind of landscape like that you arrived into? Because you grew up in Kent down south, right? So was it a big contrast when you got there, you arrived?
Totally, totally different. I mean, it was like a different country, let alone, different planet, let alone a different country. This sort of landscape of heather and mountains with clouds sort of covering halfway up the mountain, and then you see the peak of the mountain above. As a child, it was quite scary at times and inspiring. Yeah, awesome, absolutely awesome. Now, I don't remember much about the food because I was really very, very small. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing my mum and dad brought a lot of food with them. But Scotland was something special, and Dad fell in love with Scotland, and he always loved to travel to Scotland at any chance he had.
Really, really. And have you continued going there, you know, as an adult?
Absolutely. Now I've got some. I look after a couple of hotels and restaurants up there, and so I'm up there reasonably often. And I still, you know, I'm still in awe when we land in Scotland, and you just look at this beautiful scenery and this wonderful, crisp, clean air.
Oh, the air.
And if you catch Scotland on a blue sky day, there's no other place on earth like it. No.
Totally. I was actually there earlier this year when it was during a little heat wave there. Mm. And we did a road trip around the west coast of Scotland. And I'd never see, people often say that it is a bit like New Zealand. Having never been to New Zealand, I thought, wow, having seen this, it made me want to go there, because it's just the most dramatic, majestic scenery. So, I share your passion there for Scotland. And you said that you don't have that many food memories of Scotland, but growing up, obviously, you were surrounded, enveloped by food and the food world. What are your kind of early food memories?
I would say one of my very, very first food memories would be vanilla ice cream. I was probably six, maybe seven-year-old. I remember Dad making vanilla ice cream, and he didn't have any of these modern gadgets for making ice cream. It was just a pail of wood, a wooden pail with crushed ice and added salt to make the temperature go down even further. And then a wooden, iron cylinder with wooden paddles inside and a crankshaft with wheels and a handle.
Wow. So
we poured the mixture, the ice cream mixture, the inside, and then you'd have to churn it by hand manually to make the ice cream, to set the ice cream. So I remember as a child churning this ice cream. And for me, as a child, it was my ice cream. I'd made it. And the reward was that lovely first scoop of vanilla ice cream. So no, that's probably my very, very first food memory.
Putting that effort into it as well. So the effort means a greater reward at the end of it.
That's exactly right.
I've read that you can actually recall the moment that you decided you wanted to be a chef.
Yeah, my childhood was spent under the table in the professional kitchen, given bits of puff pastry to play with instead of plasticine, and pots and pans to make some noise with. It's But I actually made the decision at school leaving age at 16. I got all my O-levels and said, look, to Dad, I don't want to go to university. I don't want to carry on going to school. I want to earn a living, and I want to learn a craft and profession. So I want to be a chef. And he jumped for joy. And the rest was history, as they say.
Yeah. What do you think it was? I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but was it a predetermined thing? I mean, did you feel like there was any other alternative?
It probably was predetermined in a way, because, you know, that's like I alluded to earlier, I was born in the kitchen, spent all my childhood in a kitchen. So it was only, you know, a natural progression, I suppose, for me to then take that onto my working life. But I don't see it as work. It's not a work. It's not work.
Well, that's the best kind of work, right?
When
it doesn't seem like work. So let's move on to chapter two. And that is the first place that you fell in love with.
Gosh, first place that I fell in love with. That's a difficult question to answer, because I was born in this country, in Kent, but I was raised as a French child. So my first language, surprisingly enough, was French, even though I was born here, because my parents had only just arrived here. And so spoke to me in French. In fact, my primary school, when I went to primary school, I struggled because I didn't know any English. First place that I fell in love with, I suppose it's got to be that little village in Kent. And the wonderful school, the primary school, my first primary school, my first head teacher, Etty. I remember her name. It was just a wonderful, wonderful time and a wonderful life. And the estate where Dad was working, Fairlawn Estate, and as a child growing up there. And then going with my grandmother, who used to come over from France, and she used to bring little food parcels, so stinky cheese and salamis and pâtés and things. And then, but going with my grandmother and wandering into the woods of the estate and gathering wild strawberries, mushrooms, chestnuts in the season, and things like that. So, you know, all of that, and gathering snails as well, gathering snails and eating them. Things like that. So childhood memories of the estate and the area where I was born, it's definitely a love affair.
So tell me a bit about this estate and where exactly was it in Kent?
So just in Shibbon, this tiny village where I was born, and Dad was the chef there of this estate, Fairlawn Estate.
So you lived on the estate?
We lived just off the estate in a tiny little house. And that was part of the job. So Dad was the chef, the only chef there. And rather like a Downton Abbey or, you know, upstairs, downstairs, he was the chef of the family, private chef. So the Fairlawn estate was absolutely magnificent. There were stables there where the Queen Mother had her horses. There was a beautiful, beautiful chalk stream where trout were. There were fresh watercress. The woodland was extraordinary. It's just the most mind-blowingly beautiful estate. So we're very fortunate as a child to be brought up in that area. The perfect childhood.
How lovely. I mean, not many people can reflect on their childhood and really view it as perfect. I mean, that's just such a lovely memory to have.
Yeah, and it's one that will stay and I will cherish forever.
Oh, that's so nice. So fast forwarding then, you finished school at 16, you've told Dad, right, I want to be a chef. You trained and worked in restaurants in Paris and Lyon and Hong Kong, as well as London. And I was just really interested in the contrast between training in what I imagine was a very classical French environment and then going to the Far East and living in Hong Kong. So tell me a bit about those experiences.
Paris as an apprenticeship. I mean, Paris was wonderful. I really enjoyed that. 2 years working as an apprentice pastry chef, especially as a 16-year-old. I mean, you know, Paris was such fun. We're away from my parents and learning a craft. So that was really, really cool. And Paris is such an exciting city. It's a beautiful city. But then I really enjoyed immediately after that working in Lyon as well. And I still think Lyon, for me, is the destination city in France, especially for foodies. It's got so much on offer. Beautiful place. And then immediately after that, Hong Kong. So going from real classic French training and eating and being hit, all the senses being hit, going to Hong Kong was just like, wow, just off the scale. Being immersed in a different culture as well, and different food, and it was mind-boggling. I lived in Aberdeen, the harbour, which was in itself just crazy. I mean, you know, the fish market there was just like unbelievable. I returned actually not long ago, a few years ago, and for a trip down memory lane, and the fish market is still there and still as exciting as it was as I remember it. And the food, the smells, the passion that the Chinese and Hong Kong people have for food as well was very similar to the French passion. So in that respect, it was parallel, but different flavors, different textures, different cooking methods as well, was an absolute revelation as a young chef.
And when you went back recently for your trip down memory lane, you know, for people who haven't been to Hong Kong, what did you experience that you would want to tell somebody who was going there for the first time you must do?
Well, Aberdeen, definitely, where I used to live, is great fun. There are two markets. There's the professional fish market, which normally you're not allowed in, but you can sneak in and have a quick look again. But wear Wellington boots because it's wet.
Right. Yeah.
It's a proper wet fish market. And if they see any kind of touristy people walking around, they splash water everywhere. So you'll get your
fish. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, but it is extraordinary to see the quality of fish and the seafood there and that lovely smell of the sea, not of fish. You just smell that wonderful smell of the sea. And I think that's one of the things, actually, that Hong Kong hits you first is the smell. I think every corner, you get hit by a different smell, be it grilling fish or fresh fish, and then or grilling tripe sausages, for example, or, you know, and every corner has got something different, or sweets, candies being cooked. And yeah, you know, so it's such a vibrant city, and I think everything revolves around food, and you can get fresh food cooked to order any time of day or night.
Oh, fantastic. Well, chapter 3 is the place that you learned the most about yourself. Mm. Is that Hong Kong?
I think Hong Kong was a stepping stone, most definitely, because it taught me a lot about food, taught me different ways of cooking and different ingredients, lots of different ingredients. So I think it was a stepping stone. And I think one of the trips that I did also for me was a stepping stone, was a learning curve food-wise. And that was a trip I did with my wife. We hadn't married as yet, but it was a trip that I took the whole west coast of America. And we took a month off, and I said, come on, let's do that famous road trip from, you know, north to south, and just stop when we stop, and just, you know, stop in a motel or wherever, and just see, you know, all we know is we've got to be back home by this date. It was extraordinary because, again, seeing different styles of food from north to south, because the food scene from north to south on that Pacific Highway is completely different, totally different.
Totally.
And then the wine region up north as well was something else. And San Francisco was such a city, well, it is such an amazing city to visit. And the food scene there is just like, whoa, it's incredible. I mean, I remember going to Spargo's and for the first time, and it's still there now, and being blown away by the vastness of the place. It's huge. They cater for like 300-400 people a day, and the quality is up there. And, you know, I just couldn't get my head around how they managed to produce that amount of food at such quality and at such speed. And then Chez Panisse as well. And, you know, so all of those wonderful places that are iconic and have stood the test of time, but then also some weird and wonderful places, you know, Santa Barbara. And it's just an extraordinary trip that food wise I will never forget either.
And as you get further down south, there's more of the Mexican influence. Gosh, and the great tacos and...
oh my word, it was the first time I was actually tasting Mexican kind of food. So that flavor, avocados as well. I mean, you know, I'm going back about 40 years here. And, you know, 40 years ago, avocados here were pretty unheard of, you know, in the UK. Mm-hmm. You know, people were wondering what they were. They were very, very posh if you could get them. We'd probably buy them in Harrods, I suppose. But now, I mean, they're run of the mill. You know, absolutely run of the mill.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I was eating avocados there, I was gobbling it down, going, wow, this is a taste sensation. And, you know, with lime juice over it, lime as well, was, you know, over in the UK, was pretty unusual. And chilies, fresh chilies on everything, and these sweet and sour, sharp, peppery sauces, and barbecuing and smoky flavors.
For sure. And so in terms of learning about yourself then, was it just an awakening in terms of ingredients and inspiration and, you know, the senses?
Yes, it was. And taste-wise, professionally, yes, most definitely seeking out new ingredients and new ways of cooking. But it was also very personal, because it was definitely, I would say, the moment that I knew that I was most definitely in love with the most wonderful woman that we married a few years later, and we are still happily married together now. So, yeah.
That's so lovely. Oh. Well, Le Gavroche then, one of the world's best known restaurants, the reputation is second to none, and you took over from your father a chef de patron, or chef patron, I should say. And I mean, obviously, it was before my time, but someone that I know at that time had such a strong identity and food philosophy. And so I wondered, as a young chef coming in, taking on that responsibility, how did you strike a balance between maintaining what like Le Gavroche was all about and what the customers would expect, but also finding your own food identity and food philosophy?
Yeah, not that easy, obviously, because, you know, taking over from my father and filling his, you know, his boots or following in his footsteps, not easy. I mean, it was already an iconic, you know, destination and already, you know, fantastic reputation. So the last thing I wanted to do was radically change everything, because that would have been just shooting myself in the foot. It would have been a, you know, crazy thing to do. But, you know, there were things that I didn't like, that I wanted to, you know, modernize or put my influence to. So slowly but surely over the years, yes, you know, changing it, making it, making the food offer a little bit lighter, a little bit more my generation, but not radically changing, because it's the food that I was brought up on. It's the food that I love to cook and love to eat. So it has to remain French. But that's not saying that there can't be some other influences there. I think the worst thing you can do is to stagnate, is to not change, because then, you know, people will get bored of it, and ultimately your older customers will no longer be coming anyway because they're not here, or they're retired, or they've moved on. So you have to bring in the next generation of clientele. But evolve, I think evolve is the most important thing. Important, and of course, but staying true to your roots. So there are still some dishes that have been on the menu since 1967, like the cheese souffle, the souffle suisse, which is very indulgent, but people come time and time again for that.
It's a destination dish.
It is. Yeah. It's definitely a destination dish. And, you know, we've had third generations now coming for that dish.
Oh, that's amazing. So nice. I mean, in terms of the mainstays on the menu, cheese souffle, what are a couple of the others that are like the all-time Le Gavroche greats?
Well, we always have a sweet souffle on as well, at least one sweet souffle. And the one that seems to be the most popular, which I brought in probably about 25 years ago, is the passion fruit souffle with white chocolate ice cream. That's incredibly popular.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Right. Okay. I need to come and visit and test that out. What an amazing flavor combination. Mm. Yum. And then how would you then describe your food philosophy now? Because watching your lovely new series, I absolutely loved that first episode. It really transported me to Provence. It was a really sunny, uplifting program. And what I especially loved about it was, I think of you as, you know, one of the finest fine dining chefs. And I really loved that what you were teaching us to cook was something that was easy and something that I felt that I could do myself at home. So it wasn't in any way, you know, overwhelming in that sense. It was comforting and really just showcasing French produce at its finest. Tell me a bit about the show and the idea behind that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, French food shouldn't be intimidating. I think a lot of people do regard French food as, you know, complex and difficult, and you know, they'd rather go Italian because it's simpler. Well, actually, you know, at its very heart, French cuisine is not complex, unless you go to high-end restaurants or you know, you attempt a complex recipe, of which there are many French complex recipes, but that's not how we eat all the time and every day. And this particular show that I've done is exactly that. It's the food that I eat every day at home. So it's seasonal ingredients, like the tomatoes and the courgettes and all the other wonderful things that I cook on the show, that are local and just cooked with great simplicity. I think it is achievable. And I think it is uplifting, and that's important as well. That, you know, you watch the show and you get sort of wrapped into this lovely sort of feeling of warmth, and you look at it and you go, my word, I'm going to try and cook this. It's achievable, it's doable, and it looks delicious.
It really does. I have a bit of an issue with courgettes. Like, I've never really got on board with them because at school they were sliced up and watery and like boiled, and that really affected me. You know how when you have bad food memories, it really can tarnish your experience of an ingredient. But the way that you explained the ones that are too big would be more watery, right? Well, I'll avoid those. You go for the smaller ones, more flavor. It made me think, right, I'm going to try this and I'm going to love courgettes. Put my past behind me.
And the thing is, there are so many different varieties of courgettes as well. You don't often see them here, but in the south of France, there are umpteen different varieties and they all have a special taste. And actually, courgettes can be quite sweet, especially the smaller ones. The bigger ones can be watery and actually quite bitter. So yeah, stay away from those. Keep to the small ones.
Today's episode is supported by Naledu Private Island, an exclusive luxury island resort in the Maldives. Oh, who doesn't love the Maldives? It's where I spent my honeymoon. And after the couple of years we've all had, a taste of paradise has never seemed so appealing. Naledi Private Island is just a 30-minute speedboat ride from Male Airport and has just reopened after a complete renovation and reimagining with a new sleek Southeast Asian design. The guest experience at Naledu is totally bespoke. The butler, known as Kawanu, which means storyteller in the Maldivian language, is at your disposal 24 hours a day, both as a guide and to help with things like unpacking, serving early morning coffee, and organizing a private island picnic so you can just relax. Whether you're snorkeling with some of the 2,000 species of local sea life or choosing your very own personal menu for the day with the chef, this special resort tailors everything just for you. Visit naledu.com, that's NALADHU.com, and book that trip of a lifetime.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Let's move on now to chapter 4, which is your all-time favorite destination.
Gosh, that is tough because, like I said, I've been fortunate enough to travel the world, and hopefully we will be able to travel a bit more in the coming years. I have several, but I'm going to opt for the Seychelles. Now, the Seychelles holds particular fond memories because that's where I got married. So my wife and I eloped. We ran away. We didn't tell anybody we were getting married. no family knew, and we just got married on this lovely little island of the Seychelles in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Really?
And it was special, just the two of us. And I needed a best man. And the barman at this hotel where we were staying was particularly generous with his paws. And I asked him what he was doing the next day in the afternoon during his break. Asked him if he wanted to be my best man. He said, yeah, of course, sure, no problem. So he turned up. And my wife had a word with one of the holiday reps there, and she turned up the next day. So we had the local vicar and two witnesses that we just picked up on the day on the beach. And it was an absolutely splendid time. And for our honeymoon, we island hopped onto Bird Island, which is a tiny little speck of sand 20 minutes away from the main island, and spent a week there. So we have been going to the Seychelles very, very often ever since. And it is a particular destination that we love, obviously, because we got married there, but also lovely food, delicious food, Creole food. So it's got spice, it's got a little kick to it. The Seychelles is a melting pot of different cultures as well, because of its history and different people that have occupied the islands. So yeah, the food there is a little melting pot in itself. And there's one particular place, which I don't know if it still exists, because I haven't been for a few years now, called Marie Antoinette. And it's run by Marie Antoinette, or was at the time. I don't know if she's still around, because she was an elderly lady last time I went there. And just does Creole food and Seychelle food. And it's a very, very small menu. There's not a lot to choose from. Basically, eat what she's cooked. But she was known for her beignets d'aubergine, little aubergine slices that have been deep fried in a batter, flavored with turmeric and cumin. And they were to die for. They were amazing. You would just have those and a nice cold beer and you'd be happy.
That sounds amazing. What island of the Seychelles was that on?
So that was on the main island.
On the main island.
Yeah, main island Seychelles, just off the capital, Mahé. Bird Island, and then just hopping, just going from one island to another is just extraordinary. It's such good fun.
With the Seychelles, I mean, there are various kind of islandy places that you can go on a holiday.
Mm.
What about the Seychelles makes it so special to you? And aside from the sentimentality of it, in terms of how it feels, how it looks, what makes it stand out?
I think it's the Seychellois. It's the people themselves. They are so warm and friendly, and I love to hear them speaking Creole and trying to pick up little French nuances of Creole. And when they speak French as well, they've got this wonderful accent. It's just like, it's like Provençal. It's like being in the Provence, because it's like singing. It's beautiful. And the people are beautiful. They're warm, they're friendly. And it is just a wonderful place. If you were to compare, because it's not far, Mauritius to Seychelles, it's two totally, totally different destinations. I believe so. And Seychelles is far more relaxed.
And quite lush, right, as well? Like quite, you know, abundant wildlife and, yeah, really verdant.
Incredibly verdant and incredibly lush. I mean, the little tropical forests as well, all over the island, the main island.
Lovely. Never been on my list. So where would you pick as your ultimate culinary destination if you were the ultimate foodie? I know, what a question.
I always normally answer that with Hong Kong, because I think, you know, it's a place as a foodie to visit. Singapore equally is a, you know, foodie destination. But this one's a little bit left field that I'm going to tell you, and people might be a little bit surprised, but Las Vegas is actually quite a foodie destination. It is an incredible place. It's off the scale. It really is. It's the most bizarre place, because it's in the middle of the desert and there's just like a landing strip, or the central strip. And it's excess to the extreme. And I dip in and out of Vegas. I like going there for three or four nights, and it's escapism. You go and see a show at any time of day, and the best shows in the world, I mean, they're all there. And all the best restaurants in the world are there, from three Michelin star restaurants all the way down to burger joints or great Japanese street food downtown. It's all there. People might be surprised when I say Vegas and surprised that I actually enjoy Vegas. But in small doses.
Yeah, that is like not what I'd expect from a Frenchman, I would say, because it's kind of like quite brash and loud. But
very loud.
You like that vibe.
Yeah, but in small doses. And I think, you know what, even if you don't gamble, I'm not a gambler. When I go there, I'll maybe have, I'll take out £100 in chips, max, and that's what I do. And if it's gone in 10 minutes, it's gone in 10 minutes, and I kick myself for being so foolish. But you can go to Vegas and not gamble, but you can enjoy the madness, because it is madness. It's absolutely bonkers. But so is Macau, and Macau is another place as well, which I haven't been for many years, but I want to revisit. Amazing food. All the top chefs have got restaurants there. But you can also eat, street food and have fun. Now, let me give a little tip to all the listeners as well. When you go to a new city and you want to find out the best place to go and eat, ask the taxi driver, the cab driver. Now, cab drivers, I have yet to meet a cab driver that isn't a foodie. They all love their food, right? Wherever you go in the world, all cab drivers love their food. And they take people to and back from all the restaurants in the city. So they know the hot spots because they're always going there. But then they listen into the conversation afterwards. And the guy and the people in the back of the cab going, wow, that was so good. This was so good. The lobster at this place. Or they'll say, oh, you know what? That really wasn't worth it. Oh, yeah. So you ask a cab driver. Forget your concierge because he's normally on a backhander. Forget anything like that. Ask the cab drivers.
Great tip. Never thought of that. Great tip. Thank you, Michelle. So moving on to chapter 5, that is your hidden gem, a place that you absolutely love that maybe the listeners wouldn't know too much about.
Well, I'm going to head home for this one. And home for me is in the Ardèche. Now, don't all come flocking to the Ardèche looking for me, please. The Ardèche is one of the biggest departments in France. So I think we can all go to the Ardèche. Don't worry. It is still one of the parts in France that stayed fairly rugged and rural, because you can't really put houses down on there because it is so rugged. It is an extraordinarily beautiful part of France. The Ardèche Gorge, where the river runs through, full of wildlife, full of great ingredients. The best chestnuts grown in France come from the Ardèche region. Great fishing, great hunting, and just beautiful. The weather is extraordinary. In the summer months, it is incredibly hot. In the winter months, it gets very, very cold, really cold. But that's what we want. That's what we like. We like seasons, proper seasons. And in the winter, you have to wrap up. And in my house, we get the fire going. And it's just an incredible, beautiful place. The wines are good as well. The Rhone River flows through it. The local wines are just, perfect, with the perfect accompaniment for the food as well.
Sounds glorious. Where would you fly into or travel into to get to the best part of the Ardèche?
I always say that it's best to fly into Lyon, spend the night in Lyon.
To Lyon.
Get yourself a night.
Experience the amazing food in Lyon.
Indeed. And then hire a car and then head south. And within 45 minutes, you're already in the Ardèche. The northernmost part of the Ardèche. It'll take about 2 hours to get to the southernmost part of the Ardèche because the Ardèche is a really long département. It's quite long. It's actually very different. The northern part of the Ardèche is quite high up in the mountains and has a completely different landscape to the southern part of the Ardèche. It's almost like a different country, in fact.
Really?
So if you, really, the scenery is different. And to a certain extent, actually, the food is quite different because the northern part of the Ardèche, as I said, is quite high up in the mountains. And so even in the summer months, it's quite cool. And the food there is quite rich, whereas the southernmost part of the Ardèche is very much Mediterranean influence. So it's quite different. So I would say go to the Ardèche and spend a week or two traveling up and down towards the south, and then finish up in somewhere like Pont-Saint-Esprit, which is the southernmost tip of the Ardèche. And it's where the Ardèche River joins the Rhône River. And Pont-Saint-Esprit is a lovely place to stay a couple of days as well. Make sure you go on market day on a Saturday and just, yeah, fill your luggage and boots with all the ingredients you can on market day.
Lovely. Well, in complete contrast to that, Chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
Worst travel experience. I've thankfully not had too many. I can remember one particular scary one, though. Well, maybe not scary, but quite shocking. And the place will remain a secret, and I won't name the hotel. we did a big trip with my wife and daughter of India, and I think we took 3 weeks to visit, which is not in itself enough time to visit the whole of India. So we did kind of the West Coast, did Bombay, and then we did Rajasthan, and then we ended up in Goa. But I think it was the last or the 2 days before packing up and heading home, we went down to the swimming pool of this beautiful resort, only to find or to see two gigantic rats having a little swimming in the pool. And it kind of put us off going in. not ideal for we kind of ummed and ahed if we should kind of check out or what we should do, and we said, okay, look, we've only got one more day here, so let's just not go to the pool.
Yeah. You must have, I imagine, in your travels also experienced some pretty weird and maybe not so wonderful cuisine. Any horrendous dishes that come to mind?
Yes. Well, that's fairly simple. I mean, I don't like okra.
Oh, right.
In fact, I can't stand okra. I've had lots of people cook it for me and say, look, I'll make it really nice. You'll love it, I promise you. No, it doesn't work for me. I've yet to taste okra that I can say, that was nice. No, never.
Well, finally then, we are on to the last chapter of your travel diaries, which is Chapter 7, the destination that remains at the top of your travel bucket list.
Oh, South America. Mm-hmm. I've yet to visit South America. I'd love to go to, you know, Mexico, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, you know, all of those, Argentina, every single, there's so much to see and taste as well. That's the thing. That's the one place that myself and my wife would love to go, and that it's on our destination.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time, Michelle Root. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our big thank you to Michelle Root. You can watch Michelle Root's French Country Cooking as a box set now exclusively on Discovery Plus. Thanks so much for listening today. If you are enjoying the podcast, then don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to hit follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. And if you really enjoyed it, then if you fancy leaving a rating or a review, that would be extra special. If you want to find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. Would love to hear from you, as always. And if you can't wait till then, remember, there's all of the first 5 seasons to catch up on. Nearly 70 episodes to keep you busy there. And don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests I always include in the episode show notes, and they're also always on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.